Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically just blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you, fam.
Hello and welcome to another JW Community Podcast. By the time you hear this one, I think we'll be round about July time and we'll be getting quite close to the protest. So if you haven't booked your hotel, you might want to think about booking and coming down to London and protesting with us. But for now, we've got a really interesting guest. I'm so pleased that he's agreed to speak to us because he's got a precarious position that he's dealing with at the minute. And I think we'd all like to know what we can do to help him. But before I introduce my guest, I'm going to introduce my co-host, Nick. How are you, Nick?
Yeah, hi, Louise. Hi, Mark. Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks. I'm sweltering a little bit. It's unusual to have so much sunshine in Scotland for so many days. But I think I'm starting to adjust to it.
That's crazy. It's a big yellow thing, right?
Yeah, it's very unusual. For a few days, we were all kind of perplexed and standing around wondering what it was, but I think we've worked out what it is now.
Okay, cool. And you've just been telling me business is good. Lots of balloons being had.
Yes, lots of people having parties. So I'm all over Scotland at the moment, setting up parties and things. But it's all good.
Oh, that's epic. Nice to hear. So I'm going to introduce our guest. It's Mark Anthony Fox. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hi, Louise. Hi, Nick. I'm good. How are yourselves?
Not too bad, thank you. I'm glad it's Friday.
Yeah, it's only two more days to Monday, isn't it?
Oh, don't say that! God, that's glass half empty, isn't it?
Well, you know.
How to kill a Friday. So, Mark, for those of my three listeners who don't know who you are on YouTube, can you tell us who you post as?
I post as Witness No More.
Brilliant, thank you. So we are introducing Witness No More, and I'm just going to ask you a really open question to start with. Mark, can you tell us about your history and what led you to become a witness?
Yeah, of course. I was born in 1970. I was the eldest brother of four. My dad was a merchant seaman and my mum was a housewife. From what I can remember of the first few years of my life, it seemed to be quite normal as far as whatever normal is. But unfortunately, I discovered quite early on in life that my dad was a paedophile and he used to abuse me. And this went on for a number of years, and it ended up where there was my father and two of my uncles who all in turn or together had abused me at various points. Now this was obviously sexual abuse. My father, it was mental abuse as well. And at times physical abuse, you know, a punch in the face, a black eye, whatever the case may be. And what he used to do is to stop me fighting the abuse. He used to tell me that if I don't let him do what he wants to do, he will go and do it to one of my brothers. So thinking that I was protecting my brothers, but unbeknown to me, I wasn't, because he was doing it to them as well. I used to allow various things to happen. Now, when I got to around 14, 15, I was a really skinny, withdrawn teenager. I'd witnessed my mum being raped by my father, and when I tried to intervene, I got a good kicking, shall we say. In the 70s, if you reported something like abuse, it wasn't really listened to, and when I did report it to a teacher, again, I got a kicking when I got home. So come to 14, 15, I started bulking up a little bit, you know, doing manual things and go to the gym with a different uncle on my mum's side. Still didn't tell anybody else, but was a really, really aggressive, angry kid. And I was going out drinking at 16 and getting into fights, and I'd just turned 18 and got into a fight in a nightclub in Hull. And ended up, because of that fight, getting a job as a doorman. I was weight training quite heavily. And it was any excuse to literally inflict pain and hurt on anybody else. But I always knew that that wasn't the person I was, because after I'd hit somebody or done something horrible, I always felt guilty. Sometimes I'd go home and cry about what I'd done. It's quite bad, really. And I think it was at that point that I started looking into religion. You know, I think like anybody else, you have them thoughts, why is the earth the earth? Why do we know what words mean what? Why is your hand, who's God? And I'd been to the Salvation Army, I didn't like that. I'd been to a Catholic church, in fact, I'd been to a couple, didn't like it. I'd been to this like New Age kind of hippie kind of church, didn't like it. Looked into a number of different things. Now, because what happened to me as a kid, I didn't particularly celebrate Christmas anyway, because Christmas was never a happy time for me. So I would work, I'd work on pubs, or, you know, I was working in security as well by this point. So I would just work, and I remember having a conversation with somebody that I was working with, and we'd spoke about various things, and religion came up, and he gave me a telephone number for somebody called Dave, who was an elder. And I said, who is he? And he said, he's a Jehovah's Witness. And I said, well, I know of Jehovah's Witnesses, but I don't actually know what to teach. He said, well, just give him a call and tell him you want a Bible study. So I said, oh, okay. And I remember ringing Dave up and saying to him, hello, is that Dave? And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, you don't know me, but Glenn's given me your number. I'd like a Bible study. So it went silent for a minute. And obviously I didn't know why at the time. And he was all of a sudden, oh yeah, that'd be great. Anyway, we arranged to meet on this particular Monday night. And I went in, and I remember seeing, as I went in, Dave obviously having said to Don, and here was this impeccably dressed, warm, welcoming man come in, and he just put me at ease straight away. And his wife was the same again, impeccably dressed. His son was only young, but really, really polite and really, you know, just like the perfect family. And we started studying the Live Forever book. And I think that first paragraph really sucked me in. That with what I'd just seen, the way that these people were and how friendly they were and how loving they were. And within a couple of weeks, I was going to meetings. Within a few more weeks, I was answering up at meetings. And within less than a year, I was baptized as a Jehovah's Witness. And things were pretty good for a while, but because I had still had a lot of issues in relation to my childhood. At this point, I'm about 22, 23. My father's been arrested and got off with rape and sexual assault. But I never had the balls to stand up and say, hey, hang on a minute, he did it to me as well. Believe it or not, I actually helped him pick a solicitor. When I finally got counselling, I discovered that's because even though what he did, as a son, you still crave that right affection, you know, because all I'd been given, when you should have been taught morals and standards and love and everything else, I'd just been taught this really warped, averted version of, and it wasn't anything that I should have been taught. So yeah, he'd been arrested and he'd got off. Two of my other uncles had been arrested. One got 10 years, one got 12 years. I had a cousin who it happened to commit suicide. I don't think you could get any worse of a kind of family. My mum wouldn't talk about things, and I can understand why, you know, he'd beat her, he'd raped her, he'd done all sorts of disgusting things to her. And I couldn't obviously get any kind of closure. When I spoke to my mum, it was just arguments because she just didn't want to know. And at this point, she didn't really fully understand everything that had happened to me. So because of all this, I was still working in security. I wasn't getting a great deal of association because of my hours of work. And I was still violent, even though I was a witness. I was still violent. I was still quite a horrible person, really.
Well, understandably, I wouldn't say horrible. I'd say it was a rational reaction, actually, to what you'd undergone.
No, it was. It was horrible. I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I wasn't a nice person. So because of that, I would go to meetings, then I'd not go to meetings, then I'd go to meetings. And that kind of went on over the years. I met somebody, fathered a child, a boy called Corbin, and that relationship broke down. The only thing I seemed to do well at was being a dad and work. I excelled in work. I'd gone from security and door work. I'd gone to the gas industry, and I'd worked my way up to an area manager. But again, I was still at the meetings, away from the meetings, never resolved anything. And, I got to, I think I'll have been about 41-ish, 42-ish. And, I was kind of, I had a really close friend who I would really unleash my anger on, not physical anger, but verbal anger. I would really unleash. And this friend, he said, you know, look, you really need some help. And I think at that point, I just broke down, and I ended up going to the doctors and going on antidepressants, and I tried killing myself a number of times over the years. And since having my son, obviously I didn't do that, because, well, I don't know why, really. So that kind of happened. And I finally got some counselling. And I think that was the best thing that ever did happen to me.
Good.
And, you know, I quickly realised that, you know, I wasn't the dirty one. I wasn't the horrible person. You know, what happened to me had nothing to do with me. It was because of somebody else that, yep, that happened. You know, it was somebody that robbed my childhood. And I always wanted him to love me for being his son. Going back a few years, actually, when I was 31, my dad had quite bad health, and I'd go to the house now and again, and, you know, we'd pass pleasantries, but, you know, it was never a father-son relationship. And I got a phone call from one of my brothers. I was 32. It was September the 11th, 2000. It was the day of the fuel strikes in England. And I got a phone call saying, my mum wants us at the hospital now. And I left work and I went to the hospital, and my dad was in the crash unit, and I was stood next to him, and he was looking at me, and I remember him looking and like looking for comfort and kind of looking for me to help him. And yeah, I still feel bad to it now, but I leaned over and said, just fucking die. And I left, and that was gone home. And by the time I got home, my phone was ringing, my house phone. We didn't have mobiles. Well, they were very basic at that time, and I didn't have one. And I answered the phone, and my mum said, come to the hospital, your dad's gone. And I just fell to pieces, as you can imagine. I said to him to die, and it, you know, so that made it even worse for me. So I had all the turmoil of what had happened, and then I had, in my eyes, his death on my hands.
Oh, Mark.
So when I got the counselling, you know, I went for quite a lengthy time, and it did good. It hasn't solved everything. I've still got issues. But it's helped me understand quite a lot. And basically a couple of years back, again, like I say, I've been, you know, I'd go for 6 months a year, then I'd leave for a year or 18 months or so, go back again. And a couple of, probably about 2.5 years ago, I decided, look, I'm gonna make being a witness me. Now, it's interesting because even though I was never ever a good witness, even though I was never on the ministry as much as I should be or doing anything that I should do, I always believed everything that was taught. I thought that I were going to die at Armageddon. So when I made that decision to go back, to me it was life saving. It was, you know, I'm gonna save my life. And within a couple of months of me going back, somebody had mentioned the Australian Royal Commission, and that person obviously didn't know my background. And obviously I looked into it a little bit and then started asking questions with my local elders. And I was just getting shut down, really. Just, you know, we don't want to talk about it.
Was this somebody in the hall that had mentioned the Australian Royal Commission to you?
It was actually somebody that I was studying with, or somebody that was studying me, or was getting me back into the religion. What I didn't realise was that person had started waking up.
Right.
So what he was doing was coming for a while. We were doing the Watchtower picture, but then he was asking questions out of the normal, like, you know, if I was to say this, what would you say? And I'd be like, well, Jesus. And he'd say, but most people would say the organization, or, you know, and I didn't click at the time what he was getting at. And then he mentioned Raymond Franz, and,
wow.
So I started watching a bit of Raymond Franz. He kept coming and saying, have you seen that thing on Raymond Franz then? And I'd be going, no. And I honestly thought it was a test, you know, to see if, I did, honestly.
Yeah.
And I kept laughing, going, no, I don't know. I'll watch it another time. No. And the same with the Australian Royal Commission. You know, I was like, no, not a time. And I would just be watching it. And, you know, I mean, quite a few times I broke down listening to what was going on. And, of course, the more that you look into one thing, the more it gets bigger and bigger, you then start looking into other things. And I was finding out about the United Nations, the shares and stocks that they had, the disfellowshipping of people. And it just went into a mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
And then I think after asking, I think it was 11 elders, the 11th elder said to me, Mark, between you and me, if you carry on like this, you will get disfellowshipped for apostasy. And I kept saying, look, I'm not trying to create a problem. I'm trying to understand it. I want to be a good witness, but I just don't understand this.
Yep.
You know, this is why I came to the witnesses, because I thought that family and love was the most important thing. And when I went home from that 11th elder, I knew that I would end up getting disfellowship, because I knew that I couldn't rest without being reassured that the organisation was taking these matters seriously, that, you know, that things were in place. But when you ask somebody a simple question and everybody won't answer you, and we're not talking about that rubbish, and, you know, it's apostasy, you know, it's apostate stuff, and, you know, all that kind of thing, you kind of think, oh, hang on a minute, what is wrong here? So at that point, I made the conscious decision to record everything. And I thought, if I'm going to get disfellowshipped for just wanting a couple of answers, then I'm going to document it, and I'm going to see if other people have been through the same. And, you know, it might help anybody that's going to be the same. Now, obviously, all I was doing was putting my phone in my breast pocket of my suit.
Yeah.
And going to the meetings, and it was on clear display. And, you know, some of the footage that I got was unbelievable. I had one elder tell me, we're not going to talk about that tripe. And, you know, if you like that stuff, go be an apostate. I had people telling me that, you know, it was just rubbish. It was lies, theocratic warfare. You know, it's just political answers that they're giving. You know, it's not, it's, you know, it's okay because it's political. I asked one brother about, well, one elder, I asked him about Jeffrey Jackson, and his response to me was, who's he? And I said, who's who? And he said, Jeffrey Jackson, is he one of those apostate dudes?
And, oh my God.
I got it all on video, and I've posted it, and I was like, no, he's a member of the governing body. Oh, but I don't follow him anyway. You know, this was the kind of stuff that I was getting. And because I was asking so many questions, they finally called me in, two elders. It was Gordon and Alistair from my congregation, and they started asking me questions about the guy that I was studying with, and when do I see him, and, you know, we need to know what's going on. And what they were doing, they were planning to have an investigation meeting with me. So we agreed a date for this investigation meeting, but I'd already started posting on YouTube because I knew what was going to happen. I knew what was going to be disfellowshipped. They got wind of that. And then for about another 2.5 months, didn't do anything. And what they were doing, they was going to Bethel and with a circuit overseer to get direction of how do we deal with this guy. And then obviously I got disfellowships. On grounds of causing divisions. Now, I've gone to my disfellowshipping with about 4 Bibles, about 7 pages of notes and scriptures. And I had it in my head that, you know, I'm going to raise this point, I'm going to raise this scripture, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But anybody that, in my advice to anybody is, if you go into a judicial, do not go with a mindset of this is what's going to happen, because they just shut you down like there's no tomorrow. Mm. And quickly, what I did was I flipped it over, and I went down the route of, oh, I'm so sorry, maybe I shouldn't have done this, and maybe I shouldn't have done that, and, you know, forgive me kind of thing. And, you know, knowing that by the letter of their law, if I'm repentant, I shouldn't be disfellowshipped. But obviously I was disfellowshipped. So then I appealed. And I sat through about 2 hours of fighting my side on the appeal. And then I left the room. But what I'd done, I had a very, very old Bible, and I cut into the Bible the shape of my phone. And I actually left my phone in this Bible with all the other Bibles stacked up in the room at the appeal. And the minute I left the room, the chairman said to the others, I'm sorry that hasn't taken the 10 minutes we expected. So they was going to put my spiritual life in a 10 minute meeting, and they were laughing and joking about it. And then one of them actually said about my wallet and my books, and there was whispering about, oh, it's well, I don't want to touch it, but, you know, I'm not happy with that. And he's watching us. And it's all on the tape. It's all on recording. And then they just forgot about it and then started talking and started telling that, you know, I was disfellowshipped anyway, regardless of whatever happened, and that there was going to be following the circuit overseer's direction and have a purge. To which another one said, yeah, we've got one in our congregation we need to deal with, and this, that, and the other. So I went back in the room a couple of hours later. There was 4 members of the appeal committee. There was four members of elders from the original disfellowshipping, plus another 2 elders, all sat in this room with me there. Can we read a scripture to you? And I said, yeah, that's fine. I said, can I read one to you? So I said, no. I said, well,
no.
Stuff you don't really want to be. And off I went. And, I rang this particular elder back a couple of days later and said, I just want to know about this page. So he's like, what are you on about? No, nobody said that. I said, oh yeah, they did, because I secretly recorded you. You know, anyway, put the phone down on me. But what I'd done on the Sunday, I'd been disfellowshipped, and on the Sunday, it hadn't been announced yet, because obviously you've got that little town for the appeal process to go. You've got your first appeal. And then what a lot of people don't know is you've got a second appeal. So I'd gone through everything, you know, with a fine tooth comb of this is what I'm going to do. But interim period, I'd gone to a different congregation. And I sat right on the very front, put my bag down, gone to the toilet, and when I come back, the circuit overseer and his wife were sat directly behind me, now not knowing that I was sat in front of them. So I sat down, and within 10 seconds, 15 seconds, the circuit overseer told his wife, come on, let's move. And they went and sat at the right at the other side of the meeting hall. And it was obviously because I was sat in front of them.
Yeah.
And I had the, I presume it was the presiding overseer for that particular hall, come to me and question me about recording and this and that. And if we see you recording, we're going to, you know, we're going to have to ask you to leave and that. And I thought, oh, all right then. And I was recording, but I had it hidden. And when there was two particular circuit overseers on this particular visit, one of them was sat at the other side of the room. The other one was on the stand. Giving the speech, and I stood up and started just recording. And obviously the elders came to try and get me out. And that's the very first time that I actually did a protest. I hadn't planned it. It wasn't on my agenda. I'd done a video saying, look, you know, my appeal's in process, but this is it for me. You know, I've shared my story with you. It's now time for me to move on and enjoy my life with my son. You know, I'm a single dad. I've got a 15-year-old autistic lad. I've had custody of him since he was 7. You know, so it was like, now it's just me and my son's time. It's over. It's done. But I was that incensed at how this circuit overseer had dealt with me unbeknown to him. The fact that he sat there and he just goes and sits at the other side of the room really incensed me. And I'm one of these people, if I get something in between my teeth, I won't let it go. You know, I will see it through to the end. And that's when I first stood up and thought, you know, this, you're meant to be a loving group of people. And all I've done to you is ask questions, not to cause a problem. I wanted, even at that point, had they have sat down with me and said, right, Mark, we can't give you answers to this, that and the other, but what we can tell you is we take it seriously. This is what we're doing. That's what we're doing. Blah, blah, blah. I probably would be a witness now. So they kind of made me into an activist themselves.
Mark, I'm just going to wind back a bit because what you're saying is just mind blowing. Your story is incredible. So a few things that have occurred to me is you've just described the most horrific childhood I can imagine. And you've described it so calmly. I just think you must have done so much personal work to reach the point where you're at. Because I can't imagine any human being having to live the childhood that you've lived and not still be eaten up with anger. And I understand that you talked about how you beefed up and you became a bouncer and you wanted to hit people. That's rational. That's what any person would do under those circumstances. But the fact that you're not still like that is incredible.
Well, thank you. I think the majority of it is thanks to my son.
Wow.
When my son was born, I, you know, it's a bit of a cliche that you sit and you say something to your son, it's the first word you say, but you actually do it. I did it.
Yeah.
Sat there and I said to him, you know what, I'm your dad and I'm going to be your dad until the day I die.
Mm.
And I'm going to make sure that you have the best childhood that you can have. You know, wow. I'm going to give you what I haven't had. And I kept that promise all the way through. And when, like I said, when my son was 7, he's autistic. He's got a severe attachment disorder as well. And his mum, had had enough of him. His mum is.
Oh,
his mum.
That's and heartbreaking.
It is, yeah. And they rang me up and said, look, you know, do you want him or do we put him in a home?
Oh, that's sweet.
I'm not joking. That is what we. Well, she actually said, "Could you come and see me?" Mm. And I sat down and she said it to my face. Yeah. And that was on a Wednesday, and she said, "We'll sort it out for a couple of weeks, and then on a Sunday, come out with two carrier bags. I'll live with you now, Dad." And and that was it. So I've had to deal with my demons, deal with the anger, the aggression, everything else for the sake of coping.
And actually, having an autistic child is phenomenally hard. I've worked in a school with children with attachment disorder and with autism, and the slightest change can tip those children over the edge, can't they? And for you to have to deal with that suddenly is massive.
Well, I gave my job up. I was a district manager for a utilities company. And I used to go all over the country. I had a nice car, I had a nice expense account. And I carried on for about a couple of months after getting custody. But as a single parent, you can't, whereas before I had Corbin with me, during the week I'd stay in hotels, you know, if I was in London or Cardiff or wherever the case may be. Whereas now all of a sudden I've got to be home for my son. So I gave my job up, and for a couple of years, because Corbin hadn't been diagnosed, I spent 2 years getting him statemented with the local authority, going through the court process with them to get him statemented, getting
that's
him in the
a
right
hard job. That's tough. Yeah.
Getting him diagnosed. So I spent a couple of years going through that process with him, which, you know, helps me a little bit, you know, with my anger issues and everything else. Because obviously I had no choice. I had to ensure that my son was okay. And do you know, a lot of people that are abused apparently go on to abuse people. But I always said that, you know, if anybody who had been abused knows really what the pain is to abuse, not just the physical pain, the mental pain, the mental scars that you're left with, why would you want to do that? And because obviously I had my son and he was my first child, and you know, it was the world to me. I obviously vowed that I would, one, ensure that he had a good life and nobody touched him, and two, just made him as happy and as normal as he can be, that he could. And that, I think, that's kind of grounded me. I still have the days where, you know, I just want to scream at everybody, and I tend to just keep myself to myself on those days. And, you know, people around me know the signs now, you know, Mark's not having a good day, and, you know, they'll leave me alone a bit, and, you know, they'll encourage me in the right ways, and, you know, it's good. But I still have those days.
But Mark, I think it shows that the strength of your character and the type of person that you are. You wear your heart on your sleeve. I mean, I can totally relate to what you're talking about. Having had a particularly awful childhood myself, but as soon as my first child was born, as you say, you just think your focus is completely changed, and you think you have to do what the absolute best that you can for this poor, helpless child. And, you know, you wouldn't allow anybody to harm that child. But it does show the strength of character that you are, and the type of person that you are. I think it's fantastic. It really is.
I appreciate that. But, you know, if anything, it's him that saved me.
Yeah.
Because I think if I didn't have him in my life, I probably would have killed myself.
Yeah.
Nick, do you identify with some of these things? Because obviously you've had a similar path and you've had children yourself, haven't you?
I completely identify. I have been suicidal in the past as well, and it was the thought of my kids that stopped me. I completely relate, completely relate. So, Mark, what sort of age was your son then when you were disfellowshipped?
Well, it was only last year, so it'll have been 14.
Right, okay. Wow.
The other thing that struck me was when you were talking about your judicial committee. Now, I've not been through one, but I've read about lots and listened to lots of people's experiences, and my sort of backseat driver's opinion would be that they make a decision before you go in. And yeah. whatever you've got to, it's not about finding out the truth. It's about establishing whether you believe that the governing body is the faithful and discreet slave or not. Irrespective of any scriptures you can show them, irrespective of whether you've done what they said you've done or you haven't done it, or not, none of the facts matter. That's my impression. Now, what you said tends to back that up completely.
Yeah, like I say, I'd gone in prepared. I'd done a good week's revision and speaking with people and getting the right scriptures and getting the right understanding of the scriptures and having a plan of what I wanted to ask, when I wanted to ask it. But within minutes, I knew that I was going to be disfellowshipped. And it didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter what I was going to do. Even at the appeal stage, I think just before I go out of the room, one of the elders, Gideon, the chairman, says, but we can't have people like you in the organisation doing that. So and I said, well, you've made your decision already, haven't you? So whatever. Oh, no. And he goes, no, we're going to discuss that now. And then obviously didn't realise that I was still recording him. And, you know, when I went out of the room, they were laughing. Oh, sorry, that wasn't the fire, you know, the 10 minutes we expected it to be. You know, so they had made a decision. Yeah. And that comes from above the elders. That's your circuit overseer level combined with conversations with Bethel.
I think what people don't realise is that what an appeal is simply a new set of elders asked to see if it was correct that the original elders had made the right decision. It's not to listen to the person. It's just to listen to what the elders have to say in the original committee. So it's a kangaroo court.
Yeah, you're right to an extent, Nick, but at no point in, I can only speak for mine, but at no point in mine did they actually refer to the Bible as such. It was all the guidelines from the organisation. You know, it was just ABCD. Yeah, ABCD's right. Yeah, we'll disfellowship him.
That's it.
So the other thing that struck me is how incredibly emotionally intelligent you are. You're just so different to who I thought you were. And the other thing I thought was that you had such insight to start recording so early on. Most people wouldn't have had that insight.
I think, to be honest with you, I think it's through leading or living in the worldly world as such. You know, dealing with staff as a manager, you know, how people lie and...
Yes, and being various, a bit savvy.
Yeah, and just having my head screwed on. But I think it's also part of those early years when I was a bouncer and when I was faced with aggression and I was being aggressive myself. And, you know, I think it was partly that as well, the fact that, well, hang on a minute, they're not going to railroad me. I'm going to sort this out. I'm going to show them for what they are. But again, if somebody had sat down with me and said, you know, let's listen to what you've got to say and let's resolve your issues, let's reassure you, I'd have backed down and carried on.
And if they'd known one hundredth of what your life had been like, they should have had such empathy and love and concern for you. And instead they were just treating you like so much garbage, and all you were doing was asking questions. So Mark, what led you on to start putting videos up?
What of my actual disfellowshipping or of the protest that I do?
Well, just everything. I mean, you've been quite prolific, haven't you, I think, in your work since as an activist. So can you explain to us how that came about?
Well, like I say, it was that circuit overseer who sat behind me and then moved. That was the initial spark for me to protest. If you actually see that video, it's the attitude of the elders when I start leaving the hall and, you know, how I'm a scumbag effectively and how laughing at me and, you know, like just trying to taunt me. for me to just back down, because what I think they expect with most witnesses, they expect when they start getting clever and aggressive in their own way themselves, they expect the brother, the sister to back down and to be mild and meek and, you know, oh, sorry, you're an elder and that. Whereas I'm like, you know, I don't care who you are. It's, you know, being big-headed, but, you know, because I've been in those confrontational situations before, it's like water off a duck's back. And I seem to adapt to that kind of situation. But the initial posting on YouTube, I thought about it for a while because obviously I've been watching YouTube. I've been looking at the Royal Commission. I've been looking at, other YouTubers that had been posting, Kim and Mikey and, you know, Lloyd Evans and everybody else. I've been watching all of these channels. And I thought, well, if I put my story out there, if I get 50 people that watch it and one person kind of empathizing with what I've been through or says, I'm going through that now, then I'll be over the moon kind of thing. And it just kind of spiraled from there, really. You know, obviously, because I was going into situations and didn't really care what the consequences were, as far as the elders, I was actually getting the elders for what they really are, which is just bullies. You know, at one point I had an elder called Alistair saying to me, you know, we're not going to talk to you. This is what you people are like. You go, but I've not even been disfellowshipped. I've not had a judicial or anything. And he's telling me, go be an apostate, go join them. You know, and I'm stood there saying to him, and you're an elder. What a great elder you are. He's obviously not expecting that. I'm winding him up and he's winding me up. But the footage just showed him for really what the elders are like and what, you know, what their priority is. And it's not Christian love. It's obedience to the organization and compliance. So obviously the more that I visited halls and the more that I was looked at with disgust and contempt, the more I wanted to stand up and say, well, hang on a minute. What about the child abuse? What about the Royal Commission? What about this? What about that? And then I started making flyers. Next thing I know, I'm buying GoPro cameras and, you know, software for the computer. I'm spending a fortune on printing and, you know, I'm going to the halls looking for the circuit overseers and, you know, and it's just snowballed from there. I mean, to the point I've actually cleared a Kingdom Hall, on videos. I go into the Kingdom Hall and I have this tactic of I've got one of these big iPads, you know, the big massive ones, the size of a computer. And I've got it in a big protective case in case anybody knocks it out of my hand. And what I do is I go to the Kingdom Hall and I play them, the Royal Commission and Jeffrey Jackson. And I
was
always.
Was that not the one where you actually introduced yourself as Jeffrey Jackson? Somebody asked your name and you said you were Jeffrey Jackson.
Oh, that was the, that was the Crook Memorial.
That's right.
And I said that was Jeffrey Jackson. And at the end, he kept saying, oh, I'm really disappointed in you, Jeffrey. in fact, Paul and Debbie, who you had on your show, yes. They've all clubbed together and bought me a mug. Saying, you know, like, really disappointed in you, Jeffrey. Legally, as long as I don't refuse to leave and very, very slowly leave, I'm not breaking the law. And the fact that it's a public meeting, I'm not breaking any laws. But because I was doing it extremely slowly, the Kingdom Hall just cleared. Everybody just left, kept them all out of the Kingdom Hall for 55 minutes. Yeah. Yeah, it was unbelievable. I even turned around, you see on the video, you see me turn around and that wasn't for anything other than it was my disbelief that they'd all actually left and left me in the hall. They'd left the bags there, the briefcases, everything. And I'm just stood there, you know, and I'm like, wow, this has never happened before, you know.
That's amazing.
Kicking the ball. But I go dressed in a suit. I'm not abusive. You know, I have a laugh and a joke. I'm polite to them because I don't have an issue with witnesses as such. I have an issue with the elders and above. The elders know what's going on. They'd be blind if they didn't. And for them to defend what goes on, I mean, close to where I live, Kingdom Hall in Cottingham, which has now closed and is up for sale. There was a paedophile that had abused people for over 30 years, 20 odd offences of rape, abuse, and he got an indefinite life sentence only a few years back.
Oh.
There's a few incidences in my area of child abuse. There's one potentially that could come in the future that's just at the police stage at the moment. And it's not about the witnesses. It's about the organisation and a lot of people. Some people like the way that I crash. Some people, I don't like calling it crash. I call it visits.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I'm with you on that. Because yes, nothing gets broken, does it? You're not bumping into stuff. That's my argument.
I'm just doing return visits and things like that. A lot of people don't like it, but, you know, I can stand outside of a Kingdom Hall and those people will be on guard immediately. They won't listen to a word that you say. They'll be in, they'll be ushered in by the elders. Whereas if I'm dressed in a suit, look smart, with my little carry case and everything else, and I can get into a Kingdom Hall. I don't know who's in that Kingdom Hall. There might be Bible students in that Kingdom Hall that don't know anything about the Royal Commission. And if I, like I say, I don't speak rude. I'm polite. I'm assertive, polite. And if I can speak up, how do I know that a Bible student hasn't gone home and researched what I've said and then stopped the Bible study?
Yeah, or how do you know that there aren't children sat there, or adults who have been abused as children, who've never thought to question it?
Exactly.
Because they genuinely believe it's the truth like we did, who suddenly think there's somebody out there sticking up for me. There's somebody batting for my side that they've never thought there was anyone batting for their side before. Now, they might still go home and be totally committed to being a witness, but to know that somebody is on your side is massive. Like, you think, if you'd been a child, if one teacher or one person had managed to say to you, Mark, I'm so sorry, what's happening to you is wrong. Like, just that would have given you some sense that you weren't on your own.
Yeah.
So on that note, Mark, I mean, have you had people come to you saying, thank you so much for the work that you're doing? You actually have helped me.
You know, Nick, I never thought anybody would contact me, but the amount of people that have contacted me is phenomenal. And there's actually people in some of my videos, who have stood and argued with me, and I am now meeting those people for coffee.
Good.
And talking to them. And I'm speaking with two active elders. I'm speaking with people, brothers, sisters who were in the organisation but mentally awake, but obviously can't leave because of family. I'm speaking to a lovely couple at the moment who, the husband, in fact, I've just done a video on it. The husband was really seriously ill and dying, and the elder said to the wife was talking to an elder on the committee, you know, that you have in the hospitals, and was saying, look, you know, I haven't got anybody else. It's just me and him, you know, with no children. I don't want to lose him, you know. And she was distraught, as you can imagine. And the elder said to her, it's okay if he dies. We'll all look after you. And she said, well, you know, I don't want you. I want my husband. And she relented and allowed him to have his first blood transfusion. And then obviously they got reproved for it. And then now with this new form that they've got out that overrides any other form, they're really scared again in case he falls ill again. And you know, I think they're under no illusion that they're going to be disfellowshipped. But what I tend to do is I do get a lot of people that have contacted me. And because there's a group of us, you know, I kind of like pass people on to people.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lovely lady called Sharon Sharon and Andy, they're a married couple, both disfellowshipped, both absolutely amazing people. You know, so if I've had a female contact me, you know, I'll tend to say to Sharon, do you want to chat to somebody new? And it's kind of like just making other contacts for other people in the outside world to say, look, you know, you're not alone. If you are stuck in that organisation and you need to vent off, just give us a call. You know, if we're nearby, we'll come and meet you. I mean, I've driven all over the country, meeting people or doing visits at homes. You know, and that's what it's about, just being there to help other people that are in the same position that you've been in.
Mark, you're such a humble person. I mean, the amount of work that you're doing, and yet you're so kind of under the radar as far as activism is concerned, really. Hats off to you. You're making such a difference to people's lives, and it's really, really tremendous. Really tremendous.
Now, going back to the thing about you saying some people don't like what you're doing, I've been a kind of a fence sitter for a long time, and I've been what I would call an old guard activist, where we're like, oh, don't offend anyone, don't upset anyone, don't confirm that all apostates are all shouty lunatics. But do you know what? I think there's a new wave of activism, and I think there are people like you that would do things that I wouldn't dare do. And you've, like you say, you've kind of had the background of working in the world, sorry to use that phrase, you know, and being a bouncer and being confrontational and being able to impose your will on somebody, whether they like it or not. And actually, that is quite a good skill. And I wouldn't dare do that, but I'd never tell somebody else not to do it, because I think it takes all sorts, doesn't it? And where I'm a bit of a pussy, I think we need people like you that can do that positive activism, and I'm, like Nick says, hats off to you. And the fact that you've obviously looked into the legal aspects, so you know what's legal, you know what you're entitled to do, you know, you're emotionally intelligent enough to know that you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, and you're using that, and I think that's incredible. Can we link your videos to this podcast, or are they still off?
No, they're all back on, so you can link anything you want. But just going on to that point that you mentioned there, you know, a jigsaw, you get the final picture when you put that last bit of the jigsaw in. Them jigsaw pieces are different shapes. And I look at that like activism. You know, Lloyd Evans, Kim and Mikey, yeah, they do videos. And they sit there and they explain some good things. But then you've got the likes of Derek O'Hare. You know, some people would say he was confrontational, but I've spoken with Derek quite a lot. And that's passion. You know, that is who Derek is.
He's right, a very kind man, isn't he? I've met him. And he's just a big bundle of love when you meet him.
Yeah. And you've got the likes of Steve Rose, who did a couple of visits with me, who just wants to get the message out there. You've got Kim and Mikey that do their kind of protesting, and I've sat and watched a few of yours, Louise. You know, and I always laugh when you start up there and you go, well, you know, to do over thing, and you know, I sit there and laugh my socks off, and then I, you know, obviously I look at the thing, you've got Emblems for Life, you know, that are just this loving couple. You've got Zeb, you know, and there's all different types of activism, but those different types appeal to different people who are watching the videos, but likewise, they appeal to different people that you're doing the activism against. Some people will look at my type of activism and just say, oh, he's an apostate. And then other people won't. I'll tell you an example. I'm chatting to a lovely couple in Scarborough. And I did a visit to the Kingdom Hall when the circuit overseer was there last year. And obviously, after I'd left, the police come, and the police come quite often, and I unwitness to the police, I hang around for the police, I talk to them, and I give them as much as a witness as I do the witnesses. And about a week later, I got a telephone call saying, oh, everybody's talking about your visit. So I said, oh, well, are you? She said, yeah, and there was this particular woman in her, I think, 60s, and she said, oh, we had this apostate. She said, I saw him. She said, he was in the car park. And, This chap said, oh, was he all aggressive and shouting and that? And she went, oh no, she said, he was a big stocky lad. She said, but he was dressed really smartly. She said, and he was laughing and telling jokes. And she said, you know, he was really bubbly and pleasant. He didn't look like an apostate.
He was lovely.
Yeah. And then I did a whole visit at Leeds, and I'm stood in the car park. And towards the end of the video, one of the witnesses walks in and she goes, "Oh, you're from Hull." And I said, "Oh, have you seen me?" "Oh, yes, I've seen them." And I gave her a leaflet and she wouldn't give it to the elder. You know, she kept it, put it in a bag. The elder was trying to take it off her. But so different types of activism appeal to different types of witnesses as well. Some people will look at what I do and think it's completely and utterly wrong. Other people will react to that kind of activism and say, "Thank you. You know, is there anybody I can talk to?" Or, you know, and it just makes us, it don't make me any worse than Lloyd Evans. It don't make Lloyd Evans any better than me. You know, it's, we just all have our own niche.
Absolutely.
We're doing things.
So can you tell us about a bit about what's been happening with Watchtower Society, who you have touched their eyeball a little bit, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I seem to have rubbed them up the wrong way. They don't like my return visits.
They don't like you, do they?
No, I don't know why. it started off really when I did a second visit to Scarborough, and the police officer came out and, you know, visited the elders, and the elders gave their spiel to the police inside the Kingdom Hall, and then he came out and spoke to me, and he was quite, normally I have a really good rapport with the police, because what I've discovered is if you're pleasant to them, they'll be as pleasant to you, you know.
Yeah.
They might not agree with you, they might, you know, they might not be interested, but if you're nice with them, they're nice with you. And this officer come out and he was saying how, you know, what I've been told before. And I said, "Well, it don't matter what I've been told before. I'm not committing any offences." Before I started actually properly doing activism, I went and paid a fortune to a solicitor and got legal advice. And every time something new pops up, I go back to a solicitor and pay more money and, you know, get updated advice and what have you. I said, "So I know what I can do and I know what I can't do." And he said, "Well, if you come back later, if you don't go, you come back later, I'll be taking worst action." What effectively he was saying was he'd arrest me. I just said, "Well, you know, do whatever you have to do, because I'll be back and I haven't committed any offence. So you do what you need to do." And then he kind of backed down a little bit and started telling me how they're the victims and how they're going to take a civil prosecution out for me for, you know, restraining order and this, that and the other. Now, I had my camera on. Now, obviously that was at the beginning of the meeting. When the officer got back in his car, I went back to my car to sit. It was raining as well, so I thought, sit in my car till it's time for everybody to leave. And the officer said, "Is your camera still on?" And I said, "I can turn it off." Turned it off, and he said, "Listen, all I'll say to you is," he said, "I'm not interested in religion. I don't care. But they're claiming this, that, and the other." He said, "And they've got a dossier on you." He said, "And let me tell you, that's the kind of dossier that we'd have on somebody." He said, "It's got photographs, information, times, everything." They even had, apparently, photographs of my house when I was out doing activism, so that I couldn't say, "Well, no, I was at home. Well, the car's not there," kind of thing. They had photographs of my car, my registration, you know, lots of stuff, apparently. And he said that this is stuff that, They don't use these kind of dossiers to just sit and gather dust. No. Now, I've done visits to Kingdom Halls all over, so I speak to various people, you know, from meetings at the meetups, and, you know, who say, "Oh, there's this happening at that Kingdom Hall," and that, and that's usually where I'll tend to go. And I did a visit at one Kingdom Hall, and about a week later I got a phone call saying, "I just thought I'd let you know what's going on." And she told me that basically that, you know, the elders are using my visits to build a case against me. And then what, it wasn't just hearsay, because what she'd actually done is then sent me all the messages between her and this particular elder, who lives in a completely different part of the country, saying how, you know, they're going to get the last laugh and Jehovah's going to, through his organisation, have me arrested and this, that and the other. And then, obviously, I'm speaking to a couple of elders, and I'm also speaking to somebody via email who claims, now I can't guarantee that it is or isn't, who claims to be a part of Bethel and has told me some rather interesting stuff, but it's too accurate and combines stuff that lots of other different people have told me and builds this bigger picture.
Yeah.
So this person obviously knows something to be able to tell me everything that they're saying. And nothing, I don't think, is incorrect. And then I got a rather strange email a few weeks back, basically saying that every congregation is getting a letter that is secret. The existence of this letter apparently doesn't exist, and that this person has tried to get the copy of the letter to copy it, but hasn't been in a position to do so. But the letter tells the congregation, if I visit, and the second page of this letter is a big picture of me, and it tells them how to deal with me in accordance with the disturbance policies, who to ring, i.e. the police, what to say to the police, how to say it to the police, and what words to use to the police, such as religious hate crime, religious disturbances, etc., etc. So, you know, they are building something quite big at me. So, obviously, I'm expecting that letter from Bethel within the next few times that I do some visits. A few weeks ago, I did have, I can't go into it too much because obviously I've taken legal advice again and paid more money out on it and that, but I was in a position where I had to shut my channel down, not the channel as such, but take all the videos off, whilst my solicitor went through all the videos, because there was allegations of causing harassment, alarm and distress, inciting, I can't remember the exact words, I think it was somewhat on the lines of inciting religious hatred, and causing a religious disturbance. So I've had to take them down for a bit. Now that little bit of a legal problem has now gone away, so the videos are back up. But again, I'm under no illusion that the Watchtower will be thinking, well, we can't get him that way, so we'll go down a civil prosecution for whatever harassment, stalking, whatever they're going to try and use. And if they can get me arrested again, then, you know, they'll try that. And, you know, it's a bit of a minefield, but, you know, you can't make an omelette without breaking an egg or two, can you?
So what can people do to help you, Mark? I mean, you talked about taking legal advice. You've paid out quite a lot, haven't you, on legal advice?
I have, yes. Now this is the part that I really don't like, because I sit and I'm quite vocal about a certain somebody that his lavish lifestyle is funded by ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, and I don't agree with that in any way, shape or form. And I'm a strong believer that if you're an activist, it's a decision that you make, and you are responsible for your activism and whatever costs that incurs. And I do that, you know, if I'm going out of Hull and I need an hotel, it's all, I pay for everything myself. The fuel, bridge fares, printing, laminating, software, you know, everything.
It's had a dip, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it has. I've, in a year, with legal fees, all the equipment that I've purchased, all the fuel, you know, I think we worked it out and it was touching £9,000.
Holy moly.
But do you know what? I don't care. Because in my life, for the first time, I've found a cause that I want to fight, that I feel passionate about fighting, and that can't not fight. And that means I have to spend all my spare money and a bit more on doing that. Then, hey, so be it. That's my choice. But I am in a position where, obviously, if the Watchtower do go down a private prosecution, it's not something that you can really defend yourself, because if you lose, you end up paying the legal fees of them as well.
Well, you're fighting a multi-billion pound company, aren't you? And irrespective of the rights and wrongs, if somebody's got millions of pounds to throw behind a fight, they can make life bloody awkward for you for a long time before hopefully the rights of the case come out, can't they?
Well, like you say, they're a multi-billion pound company. I'm just one guy. I think that works for a living. Do you know what I mean? It's you can't thingy. So a few weeks back, it was a really heart-wrenching thing to do. And making that particular video, I must have made it about 30 times and I hated making it. But I did ask on a video that if anybody wanted, to try and support me in building a cushion fund for any potential, prosecution, that I would appreciate. And it's not something I'm saying you've got to help me because my way is the only way of doing it. You know, if people want to do it, and I'll tell you why I did it. I spoke to a couple of witnesses or ex-witnesses, and obviously said, look, you know, I'm at the point where I'll have to give in because I can't fight these people with this kind of money. And somebody said, look, do a GoFundMe account or, you know, PayPal account or something. And I said, I can't do that. It's my activism. And, you know, and if people don't want to, then they don't have to. So I've put that out there just to try and build a cushion fund, you know, and the money will stay in that little fund. And, you know, if it don't get used, you know, if people do it through PayPal, I know exactly who's paid it to me, so I can return it. And if it gets used, it's been used in that cause. I don't particularly want to give up my activism. If I'm faced with a situation where I know for a fact I can't win because I can't defend myself, then I haven't really got a choice. So that's that.
What sort of response have you had so far?
Not a dramatic response, but then again, I don't have a very big audience with my videos. But, you know, I think I've got about £300 in, you know, in that fund. So if anything happens, it's something towards doing. And what I'll do is I'll use what I can use of mine until I'm depleted, and that's it. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, before I removed all the videos, I paid £2,000 to have all the videos reviewed, and so that there was nothing, you know, it's £120 an hour. So, you know, I've got over 220 videos. Granted, they're not all whole visits, but the majority of them are whole visits. So I had to pay that money just to ensure that, you know, I was legally covered, and there wasn't anything that I could really be tripped up by. So, you know, that's where I am. And, you know, if people want to help, fantastic. If people don't, I'll carry on doing what I'm doing until I can't do it.
So you have a PayPal account that people can contribute to, yeah, and send money to. So what's the PayPal account email?
The PayPal account email is witnessnomore, all one word, @gmail.com.
Great. Well, let's hope we can get people behind this, because it's just phenomenal, the work that you've been doing. And it's clearly something you're really passionate about, and it really comes through on your videos. I mean, just the raw emotion that comes across, Mark, it touched my heart, and I'm sure it touches many others. And you're doing a fantastic job, you really are.
And doesn't it make sense, Nick, when you've heard the background story, when you've heard Mark's background, it makes total sense why he would be doing what he's doing. He's not somebody just going in there going, oh, I'm really angry that they tricked me into being a witness and I'm going to have a bit of a shout about it. This is deeply, deeply personal. And Mark has done so much personal work on himself first before doing this. This is not somebody just exercising his own anger on somebody. I think that's quite clear. And the background to this podcast is that, Nick, you approached a group of people, didn't you, and said, we need to help Mark. What can we do to help? And I was like a little bit sceptical. And then you sort of said, well, no, actually, he really does need some support because he's doing an incredible job. And I said, well, shall we do a podcast then? And my God, I am so glad that we did. So, Mark, where do we go from here? Do you carry on making more videos?
I'm trying different tactics now. I'm taking videos off their website and pulling them apart a little bit. I'm trying to do that on some of them a bit with a bit of humour. I'm trying to do on some of them, you know, trying to raise a few serious issues with that. But my core activism is actually going out and speaking with witnesses. So that won't stop until such time as I'm advised legally to stop, which I hope won't happen. I feel more comfortable doing that than I do sitting down and, you know, going through a watchtower or going through a video, but I'll do a mixture of both if I can. So really, it's just business as usual until such time as I can't do it for legal reasons or, you know, it's end game and we've achieved what we're going to achieve, then, you know, I'm against this organisation. But I've got to stress, my gripe is with the organisation. It is not with any normal Jehovah's Witness. You know, that a lot of these people are absolutely lovely people.
Yeah.
So I would say, Mark, that you're a man of action and you're a force to be reckoned with, and you're doing something that a lot of us just couldn't begin to do. So thank you so much for your activism, and thank you for talking to us today. Now, Nick, you know you've got to ask me if I'm going to introduce the song.
Oh, right, okay. Well, Louise, are you going to introduce the song this week?
Yeah, I am, but I've forgotten where it is.
What kind of DJ are you?
This is not funny. I've set this up. I'm sacked. I've been sacked by a guest. I'm so humiliated. I'm just going to go and stand in a corner and think about what I've done. Wait, no, I've got the song. So this is what happened. I mailed my main man earlier in the week and I said to Chris, you got to find me a song for Mark. And we went through, we've been through all sorts. Chris was suggesting like horrific things like songs by Rotting Christ or somebody awful. I said, Chris, I've got 3 listeners. What are you trying to do? Decimate me. And then we worked his way through Black Sabbath, and then we went all slushy, and then in the end I thought, shall I just ask Mark if he's got a song? And he has. Mark's got a song, and the song is This Is War by 30 Seconds to Mars. Never heard it. Brilliant. But I listened to it today and I think, yeah, liking it, Mark. It's you, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good song. So, so This Is War is Mark's song. So, Mark, I'm really grateful that you've given us all your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Thank you
so much. And I know we'll hear from you again, and I'm sure we'll have you on the podcast again, because I think you're going to be a big, big thorn in Watchtower side, and I think the more you do, I think the more people are going to be like massively grateful for what you do, because you can needle them in a way that a lot of us can't.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your support, and you know, we're all in it together, so let's all just keep doing what we do.
Oh, and you know what else I want to say? Bloody all respect for being a single parent of an autistic boy. I can't even begin to imagine that, how hard that is. I've worked with autistic children and I've worked with the children with attachment disorder, and I have nothing but respect for you, for your personal work and your activism. You're an amazing person.
Thank you. You'll have to stop now because I'll be ending up with this big end.
We don't want no criers. We don't want no weepers on the podcast. I don't know what to do with weepers. So I'll say to everybody, thank you so much for listening to another episode of JW Community Podcast. And thank you, Nick, for being my co-host.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You are now a co-host, whether you like it or not. And so say goodbye, Mark.
Goodbye, and thank you.
And say goodbye, Nick.
Goodbye, and speak to you again.
don't